Okay, guys, I've got an awesome recommendation for you. I've been looking for a smart, wearable piece of tech that I can use for fitness and health tracking and all that everyday use, but also something that's really great when I'm outdoors, having fun, going on adventures. And I have found it. It's called Amazfit. You might not have heard of them. I actually hadn't, but 42 million users have, so it's really well established. They make a ton of different smartwatches and bands and other stuff. But the watch I've been testing out is part of their adventure series, and it's called the Amazfit T-Rex 3. And I'm going to get into the tech stuff in a minute, but I just want to say it looks so cool. Even my missus has said to me, "That's a cool looking watch," and she knows what she's talking about, and I don't get those kind of compliments every day. But onto the nitty gritty stuff, when it comes to outdoor sports and adventure, it's got it all. It can track hiking, skiing, biking, running. It's got free diving. That's how much it covers, 170 sport modes and all. It's got all the usual health stuff, but check this out. The battery life is ridiculous. I've been wearing it nonstop for 10 days and haven't had to recharge it once. So it's perfect for adventure stuff, for traveling. I absolutely love it. Highly recommend it. So if you want to find out more, go to amazfit.com/armchair. And that's one word, A-M-A-Z-F-I-T. And when you get there, you're going to get 15% off your order. That's massive. So that website again is amazfit.com/armchair. The Amazfit T-Rex 3 is more than just a smartwatch. It's your personal guide to exploration, discovery, and the thrill of the unknown.
On Friday, November 15th, Netflix and Most Valuable Promotions bring you the highly anticipated heavyweight boxing mega event of the year. Jake Ogayo-Paul will go toe-to-toe in the ring against Iron Mike Tyson, the baddest man on the planet. Don't miss this epic showdown live from AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas. Watch Paul versus Tyson, Friday, November 15th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, live only on Netflix.
Hey guys, welcome to Armchair Explorer. My name's Aaron Miller. I'm a travel writer and your host. And today, this is the first of our Insight episodes. These are going to be audio documentaries that dive deep into the subjects that make places come alive. And that could be anything from anthropology and science to history to music to art and lots, lots more. But today, we're going to the movies. Gunslingers, shootout, declarations of love and revenge. The heroes and villains of Western movies have come to define the American psyche in many ways that no other genre ever has. And one of the places that has served as the backdrop to those Westerns more than any other is Utah. It's easy to see why. If you walk amongst the high buttes and desert canyons and slot canyons of Utah, it's hard not to feel like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid might jump out at you at any minute. That's one of the things I love about Utah. In fact, you really get a sense of being in a Western for real. So this episode is part of our Utah Life Elevated series. Scroll back on the feed and check out our other immersive on-location episodes if you haven't already. Really proud of those. That was an amazing trip. But today, we're going to take you to the places where some of those most iconic Westerns were shot, from Monument Valley to Kanab. We're going to dive deep into the past and learn what it was really like making those films and explore how they were made and how they've helped to shape a vision of the Old West, good and bad, that has spread around the world. Whether you're a movie buff or you've never watched a Western before, where have you been? Everyone loves a good Western. I guarantee that after listening to this, which I think is really fascinating and adds a lot of depth, not just to the place, but also the movie genre itself, you'll be itching to hop on a horse and ride off into the sunset. I hope you enjoy this episode.
The truth is that the West, broadly speaking, is a place that most people are never going to visit. So it's a place that they will only visit on their television sets or in the movies. And that gives it a kind of, you know, malleability, a kind of mythical flexibility.
I wish you hadn't done that, son.
Please, please, don't shoot! Why don't you go to my ranch and wait for me?
Wait for a dead man.
But you were always one. Some of your sweetness got into my blood. I guess it's there for life.
The Western is still a part of our popular culture. You know, it still continues to pop up in different places. Cowboys having dramatic lives out west that will still strike a chord with a significant number of people. And that's, you know, that's great. That's a great thing.
Welcome back to Utah Life Elevated. My name is Aaron Miller. I'm a travel writer and your host. And if you've been following along with our journey, you've joined us for canyoneering, mule riding, dinosaur digging, stargazing, indigenous storytelling, and so much more. Well, today we are going to the movies. In 1923, filmmakers made history with The Covered Wagon, a silent Western that also happened to be the first film shot in Utah. And once the Beehive State landed on the silver screen, it never left. Now, Utah is known as one of the film capitals of the country and the backdrop to some of the world's most famous movies. And it continues to attract some of the industry's top talent to this day, from Kevin Costner, who chose Utah for his recent project Horizons, to Kevin Bacon, who returned to the state to celebrate Footloose's 40th anniversary with the students at Payson High. How cool is that? And so today, we're going to be celebrating 100 years and counting of film in Utah, from classic westerns and contemporary horror to High School Musical and lots more. We're going to dive into the past and learn what it was really like making some of the world's most classic westerns. We're going to step onto the scene of one of the state's most iconic filming locations and explore how the films in Utah have shaped the entire world of filmmaking. So whether you're a movie buff or you've never watched a Western before, you're going to enjoy this, trust me. And I can guarantee you're going to be itching to hop on that horse and ride off into the sunset by the end.
For over a century now, filmmakers have been coming to Utah to make movies.
This is Andrew Patrick Nelson. He's a film historian and the chair of the University of Utah's Film and Media Arts Department.
Some of the best-known westerns were made here beginning in the mid-1920s. The Deadwood Coach in 1924 being an important milestone. That was a western starring the great cowboy actor Tom Mix. And really from that point on, Utah was and has remained a viable attractive location for Western filmmakers. So you can draw almost a direct line from, you know, Tom Mix making Westerns here in 1924 and Kevin Costner still thinking that Utah is the best place to make Westerns in 2024. In the 1960s or so, we begin to see a little bit of diversification when it comes to just where Utah can represent, you know, where Utah can play. We begin to see Utah standing in for kind of desolate science fiction landscapes like in Planet of the Apes. We have filmmakers responding to some of the desert and making horror films like Carnival of Souls. And that sort of variety continues to this day. You know, you get a Footloose in the 1980s, and that, you know, leads you to High School Musical today. But in all of that, what you have is Utah standing in, more often than not, even when it's a Western, for some place else, some time else. So there's a tension between Utah being America's film set and Utah seldom playing itself.
This is a dynamic which has played out through all of Utah's film history. And who could blame the filmmakers who felt inspired when they saw Utah's soaring rock arches, grazing cattle, and sagebrush blowing in the wind? Like water from a well, the landscape here draws up feeling, and film is all about feeling.
The sense of timelessness with many of Utah's natural landscapes, and also the sheer scale, has a profound emotional effect that the best filmmakers have used to their advantage. A very early example would be John Ford's Stagecoach from 1939. Right, this is not the first film that was shot in Monument Valley, but it is the film that did more to establish what Monument Valley means in the popular culture than any other film. And the shot of the sort of the famous mittens of Monument Valley, the geological formations, the rock formations, it's only in the movie for about 30 seconds, but it's the way that it's used. So we see these massive rock formations, just ancient, dwarfing this tiny stagecoach making its way through the American desert. So immediately you get a sense of the majesty, but also this sense of a disparity in size that we as humans are so small and inconsequential. And then, so there's something kind of vaguely threatening about that, both appealing, but also frightening.
Monument Valley got its start, as many do, with a lucky break. The enterprising Harry Golding, who had bought a parcel of land there with his wife, heard one day on the radio that Hollywood was in search of a place to film a Western. He knew that Monument Valley would be that place. He just had to convince Hollywood of it. So he gathered up photographs and drove out to California. And as the story goes, the receptionist at United Artists Studios ignored him until he threatened to sleep overnight in the office. And just as he was about to be thrown out, an executive caught a glimpse of one of his photographs depicting a Navajo horse rider. Suddenly, conversations were taking off with John Ford, and Golding was returning to Monument Valley with a $5,000 check and instructions to await the arrival of a film crew. From there, everything began rolling, and it hasn't stopped since. Some of the most iconic American movies of all time have Monument Valley's red sandstone buttes as their backdrops, from Easy Rider to Forrest Gump. But around the time that Henry Golding was coming back with his check, another town began attracting the eyes of Hollywood too. Its name is Kanab.
This is where the Perry brothers come into the story, these enterprising Utah brothers who tried to take advantage of the publicity around the establishment of all of these national parks by encouraging folks, you know, especially folks from California and other regions around the West, to come and visit the parks. So they kind of built up a certain, you know, tourist-based infrastructure. And that came to include Hollywood. But, you know, Kanab was sort of a town that was already there, and that made it such an attractive location for Western filmmakers in the 30s and 40s that Kanab, you know, very famously came to be called Little Hollywood. So it's less the case of, you know, a single film like a Stagecoach establishing, this is a special place, than more a story of how if you built it, people would come, you know, and the Perry brothers had the foresight to recognize that this is a place that people would want to come, and then Hollywood would want to come too.
Numerous influential films were shot in Kanab, from the original Lone Ranger to In Old Arizona, two different Planet of the Apes, A Rough Night in Jericho, and many more. Some of the world's most acclaimed movie stars have left their footprints here too, from John Wayne to Omar Sharif, Dean Martin, and Frank Sinatra. And there's one man living here today who remembers it firsthand. His name is Dennis Judd, and he spent his teenage years helping on those Hollywood sets. We went to visit him at his home in Kanab, where he and his family graciously hosted us for an afternoon.
Hey, here's the crew, guys.
Hey, how's it going? Should I take shoes off?
No. Come on in.
Wow. Look at this. Quite a collection you got here.
This is a whole lifetime of just working with the movies. Get that one to Dean Martin, Sean. They know Dean Martin.
You know Dean Martin, don't you?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
This is what the guys did while they weren't on the play.
Great guy.
This is
Gregory Peck and Omar Sharif.
Oh, wow. It's great to see these photos. Yeah.
A lot of nice guys. They were a lot of fun to work with.
So you got to know them.
Quite well, yeah.
That's so fun.
We continue into the living room, where we settle around a table piled high with scrapbooks, and Dennis begins telling us about his early life in the film industry.
So when I was a kid growing up in Kanab, you see these big trucks coming in from Hollywood, and they'd have big canvases on the back of the trucks. We'd go behind and watch them unload all of these trucks. One truck was be full of wardrobe. Now, the wardrobe, it would consist of headdresses, just elaborate, you know, fancy, fancy. And then you'd see leggings, leather leggings. You'd see a lot of fringe stuff. You'd see spears, and you'd see bows and arrows, and you'd see all hatchets and tomahawks. But right beside, you see a lot of rubber tomahawks, a lot of rubber lances, a lot of rubber steers, and all their arrows had great big rubber tips on them, you know. So then we go to the next tent, and it's all cavalry uniforms or cowboy uniforms. And they just have rows and rows of them. It was balsa wood. And it wasn't only the anvil. They brought in these big truck of boulders. Mm-hmm. If they got in the landslide business or something like that, then if you look real closely in the landslide in the movies, you'll see these boulders kind of bounce like tennis balls. You know? So that was always exciting to see see the trucks come to town. And then you see the big horse trailers come to town. And they'd be full of horses. One time we was making a show, and these trucks came to town with camels.
Over the years, some residents of Kanab grew so accustomed to the coming and going of movie making that it started to feel like normal life. In fact, in 1945, Saturday Evening Post journalist Floribel Muir wrote, "A flock of screen stars strolling down Kanab's dusty main streets excites no more curiosity than a stray sheepdog chasing its tail." But for many more people like Dennis, the excitement of movie magic never faded, and they were eager to be a part of it.
Most of all, Kanab was hired to be in the movies as extras, or sometimes even actors, or wranglers, or teamsters, or chauffeurs, or drivers, or cooks, or we call greensmen. You know what a greensman is? If you're sitting having a scene, and the producer or the director said, "Oh, I got to have a tree there, or I want some sagebrush there, or I want a bush there," then come on, greens man. And so he'd come and he'd put some sagebrush or a tree or whatever they wanted. So when these companies come to Kanab, they had to use the Kanab local cowboys to drive for them, be chauffeurs, because of the sandy roads and stuff. And they'd get lost anyway. So one of my early jobs was my car. I always had the director or the producer in the car with me. And they always used to tell me, "Dennis, anything we say, don't go any further than this car. Because there's always talking about some actor that did something wrong. We got to get rid of him, you know."
Dennis quickly earned their trust, helping however he could, driving directors, casting local talent, scouting locations, anything they needed. And then he moved into wrangling, one of the more coveted jobs on set for its high pay. Each morning, he rose at 4, gathered anywhere from 50 to 300 horses, fed and watered and saddled them, and brought them out for a sunrise shot. And working as a wrangler led him down yet another path.
Being a wrangler is how I kind of got into the stunt business. They were making Rough Night in Jericho, and they wanted a stand-in for Dean Martin. And in those days, I had long black sideburns, and they said, "Hey, you'll be a good stand-in for Dean Martin." So, sure, why not? I'll be glad to. So I would become a stand-in for him. And then while I was a stand-in, they wanted somebody to ride a bucking horse. Well, I can do that. And I was already dressed. Where's that picture, Kathy, of me and Dean Martin?
It's there.
It's hanging on the wall. You got to see this one. So anyway, then they said, "Okay, yeah, I'll ride a bucking horse. I'll be glad to." So I rode the bucking horse for him, and he rode the barrel. And then they also, for some reason, put me on a mule coming down off this side hill. And so in the meantime, I got to be close to Dean Martin. I rode in the same truck with him and talked with him and got this picture with him and I. So that was probably my first stunt.
What were some of your movies that you're most proud that you've worked on?
Well, probably that Hidden Secrets of the Grand Canyon is probably the cream of the crop, because we spent a year making that show.
The Hidden Secrets of the Grand Canyon tells the story of John Wesley Powell, who famously lost half an arm in a battle and went on to lead a mapping expedition down the Green River, including Utah's Flaming Gorge. Dennis Judd spent months searching for the perfect actor for Powell, one with the arm lost in just the right place. These were the days before CGI, of course. But he had no luck. Casting call after casting call, the leading man evaded him, and he wondered with increasing despair if the film would even be able to happen. And then one day, as he was walking through the airport, Dennis says he saw him, his John Wesley Powell, a complete stranger standing at a payphone. But nonetheless, Dennis approached. "Excuse me, sir," he said, "but I have a proposition for you." The man had never acted in his life, but he took the role, and the rest was history.
So I got another story to tell you. I had a phone call from these guys, and they were in a helicopter, and they were flying up in northern Utah, and they were looking for a place to do a music video. And they said, "We're going to come to Kanab and look for locations." And so they came to Kanab, and I met them, and they were here with Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Chris Christopherson, and Johnny Cash. And then they wanted to have a scene of Waylon Jennings. He's a dam builder, and he's singing about building this dam, and he gets struck by a bolt of lightning, and he falls off the dam. Well, they wanted me to do that part. And so I dress up like Waylon Jennings, and they put me on top of the Glen Canyon Dam out by Page. And on that dam was this big crane. Well, they put me up on top, this big crane with a dummy. So I get up there, and the bolt of lightning comes down and strikes me, and then we throw off the dummy. It shows him falling off the dam down the depths below. So that was a fun show to do, yeah, you know, man. and so that worked out right.
What's it like being an extra or playing a part in a movie?
You think you're a movie star because they come up and they want to make you up. If you get any close shots, so they make you up, you know, and they comb your hair for you. You just feel like a movie star. It's kind of fun, you know?
Dennis spent decades mixing on set with some of the greatest stars of the ages, including one group you might have heard of.
The Rat Pack. Have you heard of the Rat Pack?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford. They came to Kanab, and they stayed at Perry Lodge, and they made a movie called Sergeants 3. Right across the street from Perry Lodge is our old school, and we had a football field. They'd land their helicopters on our football field, and then the Rat Pack would walk across the street from Perry's, get in the helicopters, and fly out 60 miles to location to film the day location. Dean Martin wanted to use our runway to land his Learjet on. The runway was too short, so he paid extra to have the runway extended so we could land his Learjet on that runway. When they left, they bought the back page of our local newspaper and all signed their autographs on our back page.
What's it like watching a movie in the movie theater after you've worked on it?
I sit here all day and watch movies that were made in Kanab. I love it. Yeah. I love it. And it's not the sense that I had anything to do with it, but I really enjoy trying to bring up the old timers that I was just a kid. Yeah. When I first started in the movie business, I was just a kid. I mean, I was probably 15, 16 years old. I'd go sitting, when I wasn't doing anything, I'd be sitting in the old bus, and the bus would be full of old cowboys. And these old cowboys would be telling old stories about their experience, either cowboying or somewhere or something. And that was always fascinating to me.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you think the appeal of the West is? Like the picture you're painting there of the, you know, the cowboys and hearing all the old stories. But so many of us didn't grow up in the West and with that experience, but we're drawn to it, right? And the closest we can get to it is the kind of movies that you worked on. Yeah. Do you think that, you know, those old Westerns, that is there something in the spirit of that? Like, I'm wondering why, like, someone from Europe, for example, might really connect and want to experience that feeling of the West. Is there something about the kind of freedom of that time, the open space? Because that's not something that we get a lot in the modern day, you know, the ability to just disconnect and be in a beautiful place.
And walk someplace where nobody's walked before. We still have places like that here around Kanab where there's no footprints. Mm-hmm. And you can still feel like you're an individual, not a number in a roll book, you know? So we have a lot of places like that here.
Yeah. Well, you've had an incredible life. Thank you for sharing your stories with us. Yeah,
my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you'll have heard me shouting about a clothing company called Doer, as in built for doing. I really love this partnership because I genuinely love their clothes and they're perfect for the kind of thing that I think we as a community are looking for. First off, they are super comfortable, super stretchy. I go for a lot of walks in the day, mainly because my dog is a master at making me feel guilty. And these things honestly feel like I'm wearing hiking pants slash trousers. Secondly, and no offense to hiking pants, they don't actually look like hiking pants. I want to wear something to work that looks cool and feels like I've made a bit of an effort. And they do. I love their style, and they've got a ton of great winter all-weather jeans that are water and windproof, so you can still get after it no matter what the weather. And check this out. If you roll up the bottom of the legs, there's even a reflective strip on some of their jeans for riding your bike home safely after work, or presumably tearing it up on the dance floor. How ingenious is that? So go ahead, do what I did, and upgrade your denim with Doer. You can check out their flagship stores in LA or Denver, or just shop online, shopdoer.com, explore. That's D-U-E-R. And right now, if you use that URL, you are going to get 20% off your first purchase, which is massive. So remember, it's shopdoer.com/explore. That's an awesome deal. So don't wait. Get that 20% off. Get doing. You won't regret it. I highly recommend it. Check it out. shopdoer.com/explore.
This episode is brought to you by United Airlines. When you want to make the most of your vacation, book with United. They're an airline that cares about your travels as much as you do. United is transforming the flying experience with Bluetooth connectivity, screens, power at every seat, and bigger overhead bins to help fit everyone's bag. And with their app, you can skip the bag check line, get live updates, and more. Change the way you fly. Book your next trip today at united.com.
Our ideas about the West can be traced back to a moment when the Western was the most popular movie genre, not only in the United States, but, you know, very popular around the world, at a time when movie going was the primary form of entertainment.
Andrew Patrick Nelson again.
So from, you know, the 1930s through to the 1960s, the Western, you know, saturated our popular culture in a way that you needed to experience to really understand. And it's not just movies. It was on television. It was in advertisements, comic books, popular fiction. You know, the Western just was everywhere. And it was, at that time, the form that we were using to try to help to understand, you know, who we were and where we had come from. And this is often the explanation of the Western, the idea that it promoted a certain image of American history, a certain portrayal of the American character that resonated with large numbers of people. And it's usually sort of characterized as advocating manifest destiny or a kind of rugged individualism in the Teddy Roosevelt sense, and, you know, very, you know, clear-cut morality, and that we look back on that and we think, well, of course, that made sense in the post-war era or some moment where we were dealing with traumatic cultural change. And so we latched onto these, you know, fairly simplistic myths that told us, you know, not only who we are, but that we were right in everything that we had done. And I am here to tell you that that is just plain wrong. That is just far too simplistic. That anyone who has actually watched Westerns, even the greatest Westerns, you know, Westerns starring John Wayne, will find that they are deeply complex texts with heroes who are not painted in shades of black and white, but in shades of gray. These are films that addressed, you know, directly many of the problematic aspects of American history about colonization, for example. And why would we expect anything less of the popular culture of the past than we expect of the popular culture of today? So the Western was, in its heyday, an incredibly complex text that could accommodate multiple perspectives. And that is the real explanation of why it was so resonant, is that so many different people could watch a Western and see themselves in it, not because it was doing one thing, but because it was doing many things.
The Western, Andrew says, had an almost mythical flexibility. Even the idea that Utah as a place could stand in for other states, other countries, even other planets, that the hero could take on the role of savior, villain, complex individual. All of this allowed for a malleability, which Andrew says is so integral to the heart of what a Western truly is.
And this was the case around the world too. You know, the Western is often accused of, you know, sort of promoting an imperialist ideology, let's say. And yet the Western was incredibly popular around the world, including in many countries that were, you know, suffering under those ideological formations, that where people were suffering under colonialism. And what's interesting is then, you know, by the time we get to the 60s and 70s, people in those nations, you know, in India, in the Caribbean, in places in Europe, begin to make their own Westerns. And, you know, they're Westerns that are very different than a lot of American Westerns, but they tell us that they saw something different in those very same movies. And that's, you know, that's an amazing, remarkable thing. People in these nations who were suffering under, you know, conditions most of us can't imagine, instead saw these cowboys in their triumphs and saw in it some kind of liberation, you know, in ways that maybe we can't conceive because of our circumstance. So I am just, you know, endlessly fascinated at the diversity, the complexity of American Westerns, and just the infinite number of ways that they have been, you know, interpreted and then allowed new artists to take their place in this evolving generic tradition. I mean, it's just an amazing story that I don't think we tell enough, just how amazingly complex it was.
A quick internet search for Westerns made around the world has films listed under every single letter, from Bolivia to Thailand, India to Sweden. And this, Andrew argues, is one of the reasons the Western has endured far longer than the brief time span in which its stories are set, outliving many other genres. And it's still going strong. From Yellowstone to Westworld, the Wild West continues to captivate the cultural psyche, not because of its simplicity, but because of precisely the opposite.
The thing I might point to is, you know, how a lot of Westerns end. Not all Westerns, probably not even majority Westerns, but the most famous Western ending is the hero riding off into the sunset, right? Okay, so the hero has spent all of this time, you know, purging the town of evil, and yet he can't stay. Well, that's not a happy ending, right? That the hero has no place in the society that he's helped to bring into being. Now, we understand why. It's because the hero is kind of, you know, he has an affinity with violence that society can't house anymore. But, you know, that, if we think that that's the fundamental Western ending, that is a deeply tragic ending that raises so many questions about the comparative value of, you know, so-called civilization. That, you know, this guy we valorize, who's better than all of us, like, we expel him, he has to leave at the end of the movie. I mean, that suggests a genre not that is straightforwardly triumphalist or simple or providing simple solutions, but one that is keenly aware that in the ongoing struggle between, let's say, civilization and wilderness, that there are costs associated to progress. And one of those costs is that the best among us have no place in society. Like, you know, chew on that.
If the archetypal Western ending is a horse riding into the sunset and the beginning is a pair of boots entering a tumbleweed-strewn town, what happens between is more often than not riddled with bullet holes and soaked with blood.
Westerns are filled with conversations about the very real consequences of violence, that it takes a toll on a person, like a mental toll, not only on their, you know, sort of their relationships, but on who they are. And so these conversations take place, you know, in Westerns in the 30s, they take place in Westerns in the 50s, they take place in Westerns of the 1990s, like Unforgiven. You know, this idea that, you know, actually taking a life has consequences beyond the kind of the immediate act. And that even if a killing is just, it scars you in a very deep way, in a way that you never recover from. I mean, that, you know, at its best, that's what the Western has been saying. So again, we kind of have these rituals of, you know, gunfights at high noon, but there's always been a kind of explicit discussion around, you know, when is violence justified? Part of that too is oftentimes Westerns are telling us that, you know, these very institutions that we rely on, like law and order, are in fact not sufficient because they can be corrupted. You know, religion can be corrupted. There's a famous line in The Shootist, which is a Western that John Wayne released in 1976, where another character, Bond Rogers, who's played by Lauren Bacall, is trying to get him, you know, suggest that he should come to church with her. And he, you know, responds that he's never been much for church going and that his church has always been the mountains and solitude. And I think that, you know, that's kind of what the Western is. So, you know, when it comes to these rituals, but actually asking questions about violence or the kind of corruptibility of, you know, earthly institutions, I mean, the Western has been asking these questions for a century now.
A And if Westerns serve as a cultural kaleidoscope, rearranging the fragmented pieces of our histories and casting them into doubt, they also serve to beautify our existence, shining that rose-colored light on a romantic version of Western life. But unlike the early violence of the West, the romanticism of the West can, in a few places, still be found. And to experience it for ourselves, we're heading out into the backcountry for a Stars and S'mores experience with the Adventure Tour Company of Kanab. The sun is hanging low in the sky, and the insects are a-buzzing. If you're like me, the first time you heard about the West was when you saw it on the screen as a little kid dreaming of being one of those cowboys riding off into the sunset on horseback. And that's what draws a lot of people here to Utah. And you can feel that on the back of the horse. You can feel that rappelling into a slot canyon. You can feel that hiking the same riverbeds that Butch Cassidy once did. But if you want a treat, you can also go behind the scenes to where the magic was actually shot. We're in the back of the biggest truck I've ever been in, looking at some open windows at a beautiful Utah sunset. It's hard to look at a landscape like this, just fields of sagebrush fading away into these golden red rocks and cliffs everywhere. It's really hard to feel like you're anywhere but a Western film set. And guess what? That's exactly where we're going now. We're headed to Fort Kanab, one of the most iconic locations in the country for Westerns. We're going to find out all about some of those Wild West tales. We're going to eat some s'mores, and we're going to sit around a campfire, and we're going to have some fun. Are you ready, partner? Let's go. Rows of sagebrush and gnarled pine trees pass by in a blur, and we rumble past enormous pastures where longhorn cattle graze serenely. As we arrive, we catch a glimpse of the dilapidated fort, old wooden beams sagging in on itself, the picture of history and the Wild West.
Come on, I'll catch you.
Okay.
All right. We're here. We've arrived at the fort. We meet Norris Church, who's hosting us, and he looks the part in finely crafted leather chaps and the best cowboy mustache I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. How's it going?
Good.
I'm feeling really underdressed now.
We've got a little bit for dinner, waiting on the Dutch oven potatoes. So come on up by the fire.
Great. Thanks for inviting us over. It's a beautiful spot. We enjoy some old-fashioned cowboy hash cooked over an old cast-iron Dutch oven with smoky potatoes and roasted corn, beans and peppers. We make our s'mores sitting around the campfire as the sun sets and the moon rises over the old fort. Somewhere beyond the glow of the fire, a raven cries. And then Norris begins to tell us why we're here.
So I'd like to welcome you to the Kanab Movie Fort. So this building that we're sitting here by was actually originally built in 1932 for a movie called Pony Express. So that's back before, you know, they were kind of like spaghetti westerns. There wasn't really any sound or anything. And it's actually, there's been about 32 different westerns that were filmed here. Kind of one of the main ones that were filmed here was like F Troop. So F Troop was actually one of the lot, you know, this entire building here was actually, and that, so that series ran for 16 years. So that's the longest running series that they've ever had here in Kanab. And, you know, since then, it's like we had movies like The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again, which that was in 1970. And so the building that's behind us right now was actually from 1932 to 1970. But then in 1970, when they were filming the Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again, there was one of the scenes in that the fort caught on fire. So they had run gas pipes around the building to make it look like it was on fire. Well, it actually caught on fire and burned about three quarters of the facility down. And they ended up having to rebuild it.
Like Dennis Judd, Norris has plenty of stories. He hails from a long line of ranchers in Kanab, sixth generation, and his family has helped wrangle horses and create Western movie magic for decades. In fact, Norris's dad worked on the Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again.
And in one of the scenes, they had like all the cavalry stacked along the fence here. And earlier in the week, it was the director come across, and it's like, okay, it's like, I want you four, when the shooting starts, I want you to fall off your horses. I'm gonna give an extra $5 a day. So at that point in time, there was only probably about 1,200 people that lived in Kanab. They pretty much employed everybody in town. And at that point in time, they're only making about $2.50 a day. So if somebody comes up to you and says, all right, I'm going to pay an extra $5 just to fall off your horse when the shooting starts, it's like, well, heck yeah, I'll do that. But then it gets spread around a little bit. So you've probably got, you know, 60 guys standing up on the wall. And so the day of the scene, director yelled action. Well, all 60 fell off of the horse. It's like, no, I only paid you 4 to fall off there. I'm not paying everybody else. And it's like,
I want to see that cut of that scene, you know?
You know, if they would have had bloopers back in those days, yeah. Or the, you know, like the gag reels or whatever, yeah, it's yeah. Like, that would have been amazing. Because it did. It happened, you know, quite a bit. And so it's a lot of fun watching, like, these old Westerns. It's like, I know where that is. You know, it's like McKenna's Gold. It's like, I remember my dad telling me about that because it was up in Kanab Canyon and they had a big rock slide on it. And they're all styrofoam rocks. And so he was out one night, had a hot day, you know, whatever. But he knew, because he was on that set, they knew where these styrofoam boulders were. And so there was one they'd kind of rolled down on the road and he had, you know, had the girlfriends out with him and his buddies, and there was a rock laying in the road. It's like, hold on. It's like, I got that. And he went out there and picked up this boulder about the size of the fire ring, and it's just like, and threw it off into Johnson Wash. Super impressed him. It's just like, okay. So there was a lot of, I guess Hollywood had to put up with us out here. Not that we're not any troublemakers, we just like to get in a little bit of mischief type of deal.
The fact that you're a sixth generation rancher here, that's pretty impressive. Could you tell a little bit about that story and like what it means to you to be continuing that tradition?
I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, I've been around, you know, it's like I've worked up in Wyoming, North Dakota, and I guess if you grow up here, you still end up coming back to it because you get the red dirt in your blood and your socks, and you can't get rid of either one of them. You're going to find that out if you're here very long.
Yeah, it's a special place. It really is. Do you think some of that Hollywood magic over so many years is kind of like rubbed off a little bit so that when people come here, they get a little bit of a feeling of what it might be like to be in one of those movies?
I think so. So you guys have seen Cars, right?
But of course.
Yeah, so the animator for Cars actually lives here in Kanab.
Oh, yeah?
So, you know, when Lightning McQueen and Sally are driving up through the canyon?
Oh, yeah.
That's actually up to Bryce. What about Lion King?
Yeah, duh.
Lion King. So there's actually a rock up on the sand dunes just north of town. It's Pride Rock.
What is it you think about Westerns, like, that people just love all over the world? Like, people that don't even live here or know anything about it still love a good Western.
So, I think a lot of that, it's like the Western lifestyle, like the Western experience, it's like, they can't believe that people just live out here on the land, you know, under the stars that we have right now, which, you know, living here, we take that for granted. But you get a lot of people that come out here and they're just like, I mean, we've had people from Texas, never seen the Milky Way. And I think a lot of it, like being out here in the West, maybe it's just the freedom of it. I guess like get on your horse or your four-wheeler or whatever and just go.
It might seem like a fever dream on the silver screen, but here in Utah with longhorn cattle grazing just a few feet away, stars wheeling overhead, and the fire shooting off sparks in front of us, that rugged West is alive and well. And as Norris tells us, the people around here have plenty of true stories just as good as the ones in the movies.
So you guys have been around here long enough, so you've seen like all the juniper trees around here, right? So, did you notice what's growing in them?
The white berries.
The little purple, white-looking berries. What do you make out of those? You make gin. So all you need is the berries and water, and you can make gin out of them. So there was actually, back in the Prohibition days, there was actually two brothers right here in Kanab. In fact, when you guys came in on this road and you made that 90 to come up to here, that fence line you guys followed in was the Utah-Arizona border, but it's also the Paiute Reservation. But these two brothers, they decided to start making gin. And they had a saloon set up right there. So the old boys, they'd come down there to check the cows or the water. Well, they'd slip by these two brothers' saloon and get their jug and then head back. But these two brothers, where they put their saloon up, it was actually on the Utah-Arizona border, but they had it sitting on logs. But where they had it sitting, they could see to the south, you know, into Arizona, and they could see to the north into Utah. And so they could see if the Utah or Arizona sheriff was riding up on a horse. So the reason that it was set up on logs is because at that point in time, you know, the Utah-Arizona, they couldn't travel across the border. They had no jurisdiction. So depending on who they seen coming, they'd roll that saloon across the border, you know, one way or the other. So it got the name, the Rollaway Saloon.
Rumor has it that the town council, which was all women at the time, grew tired of having their husbands come home toasted on gin. So they asked the brothers to roll away their saloon permanently. And when the brothers refused, they did what so many did in the Wild West and helped them to leave. And while the Rollaway Saloon was eventually found miles away from town, buried in sand, the brothers were never seen again.
That one's actually one of the real Old West Kanab stories.
Well, listen, man, thank you so much. This has been such a perfect evening. Yeah, it's been so much fun. Best stories ever. Amazing stars.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
So, you want to be a marketer. It's easy. You just have to score a ton of leads and figure out a way to turn them all into customers. Plus, manage a dozen channels, write a million blogs, and launch 100 campaigns all at once. When that's done, simply make your socials go viral and bring in record profits. No sweat. Okay, fine. It's a lot of sweat. But with HubSpot's AI-powered marketing tools, launching benchmark-breaking campaigns is easier than ever. Get started at HubSpot.com/marketers.
The main reason people should watch old movies in general, but, you know, Westerns in particular, is just so many of them are just good.
When you come to places like Kanab and Monument Valley, you get to live out your Wild West fantasies for real. But until then, there are a few Utah Westerns you simply can't miss.
So the top five, Introduction to the Western by Way of Utah. So, you know, 1939 is an important year for the Western. Many great Westerns are made that year, many of them with Utah connections. Another one would be, you know, Union Pacific. But the Western that really stands out from 39 is Stagecoach, which is a dramatization of an imperiled stagecoach making its way across the American West and is in some ways a breakout role for John Wayne. So that's an important film with a Utah connection, because that in some ways is Monument Valley's breakout role. If we fast forwarded 30 years, we would go to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which is another Utah-made Western. And it's, you know, an attempt to tell a different type of Western story, a more contemporary one. So it's important in that way. But it's also important because it was the film that really made Robert Redford fall in love with Utah. So, you know, if we don't have that, we probably don't have Sundance, and we don't have Utah as the kind of film destination that it's become. So those would be my big two, I would say. Wagon Master is a really interesting film. It's another John Ford film from 1950. It's a modest film. You know, it doesn't have John Wayne or Jimmy Stewart or Henry Fonda in it. Ben Johnson and Harry Carey Jr. and Ward Bond are the lead. So it's an interesting movie. It tells a kind of thinly veiled Utah story of a trek of Mormon pioneers. So that would be one. You know, certainly The Searchers from 1956, generally regarded as the greatest Western, John Ford, John Wayne. Another film that is not a Western, but was made in large part in Utah and is aware of the history of, let's say, the representation of the American West in popular culture, would be Thelma and Louise from 1991. So, I'm not making the case that it is a Western, but it is a film that is set in the West and is aware of its connection to the kind of the representational strategies and some of the values that have been built up around the Western. So that would be a kind of an interesting counterpoint to some of those classical Westerns. And then if you wanted to, you could circle back around to other Westerns, other later Westerns. So, you could watch some episodes of Yellowstone, for example, or you could check out, Kevin Costner's Horizon.
The Western is as finely layered as the red desert rock that serves as its backdrop. Ever since they emerged, Westerns have been rife with opposing viewpoints, contradictions and complexities, smoking guns and dramatic declarations of love and rides off into the sunset, as varied and complicated as the people who made them and the people who watched them. And as we look ahead to the next 100 years of film in Utah, it feels impossible to know where the industry is headed and where that trail of questions and beauty and reflection will lead. But to use a fitting metaphor, we're sure as hell going to be along for the ride.
The hope would be that Utah would continue to attract the types of productions that have characterized filmmaking in Utah from the beginning. You would hope that the big Hollywood studios would, continue to look to Utah as a place to make blockbuster films, whether it's a Western like Kevin Costner's Horizon, whether it's science fiction films like Independence Day. You would hope that those productions would continue to come here. But at the same time, you would hope that something more like an indigenous filmmaking tradition would take hold. You would hope that there would be more opportunities for local independent filmmakers to, to make films, to tell stories that are about Utah that might have an appeal beyond the state. And, there are certainly some examples of this over the past 20 or 30 years. A film like SLC Punk can take us out of the desert and into the city and explore a really unique subculture, and that can resonate. From my perspective, I've got 700 undergraduates who all aspire to be filmmakers, and there are thousands of film students in the state of Utah. Many of them would like to stay in Utah, tell their own stories, many of which are Utah-based stories. And so, the hope, the eternal hope, is that there's room for both of those, that it doesn't have to be one or the other, and that we can, still be the favorite destination for the Hallmark Channel or Kevin Costner, and they can use our talented crews and enrich our local economy. But at the same time, it would open up spaces for our own filmmakers to start telling our own stories.
Thank you so much for joining us on Utah Life Elevated, and make sure to check out our other episodes if you haven't done so already. Thank you to Visit Utah for their help in making this episode possible. And if you're interested in planning your own trip to Utah, or maybe starring in your own Western out there too, a great place to start is visitutah.com. And we want to thank everyone who featured in today's episode. Dennis Judd and his family for graciously hosting us. Norris Church and all the team at the Adventure Tour Company. You can book your own Stars and S'mores experience online. Go and check that out. And Andrew Patrick Nelson. He has his own podcast called How the West Was Cast. So do go and give that a listen. So thank you so much for listening. I'm going to see you next time for more of Utah Life Elevated. This episode was produced by Armchair Productions, the audio experts for the travel industry. Jenny Allison wrote and produced this episode along with me. Field recording was done by Jason Patton, and Charles Tyree did the audio editing and sound design. I'm Aaron Miller. Thanks for listening.
I'm Whit Mistledine, the creator of This Is Actually Happening, a podcast from Wondery that brings you extraordinary, true stories of life-changing events told by the people who lived them. From a young man that dooms his entire future family with one choice, to a woman that barely survived her roommate, we dive into what happened and hear their intimate, first-person account of how they overcame remarkable circumstances. Follow This Is Actually Happening on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts, or listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
I did consider Barney a friend, and he's still a friend to this day.
The idea of Barney is something that I want to live up to. You know, I love you, you love me. I call it the purple mantra.
Barney taught me how to be a man.
Generation Barney, a podcast about the media we loved as kids and how it shapes us. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.